This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And in today's program, we'll have the latest on the Korean nuclear, military, and political crisis. We'll speak with Hyun Lee of the National Campaign to End the Korean War. On that topic, also today, Harvey Wasserman on the latest nuclear power plant accidents and the consequences of Fukushima on children and neonatals. All of that and more, including a reminiscence of the Reverend Doctor. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And as we speak, there are major crises developing on the Korean Peninsula involving the movement of troops, of missiles, and military exercises. And to help understand the broader context of what is happening in that region, we're very pleased to be joined today by Hyun Lee. She's a member of the Working Group on Peace and Demilitarization in Asia with the National Campaign to End the Korean War, and also our broadcast colleague on Asia Pacific Forum. Welcome to 5 o'clock shadow.
Hi, good evening.
Well, as we speak, even now, there are threats of regime change against the Democratic People's Republic of Korea emanating from circles in Washington, D.C. There are ongoing joint military exercises with South Korea and the prominent flights of stealth fighter bombers in the region, and missile placements being enhanced in Guam, and very strong rhetoric coming from all sides at this point in time. Hyun Lee, can you just give us your assessment of where we are at this moment of crisis?
Yes. Well, first, let me just say that as a Korean American, with people that I care about on both sides of the DMZ, in both North and South Korea, the situation right now is of grave concern to me. And right now, I there are people in Washington circles who like to downplay the current situation, saying, oh, we have seen this before. This is part of the same pattern of behavior from North Korea that we have seen in the past. I think it's unwise for us to ignore the seriousness of the current situation. The situation that most concerns me is an agreement that was recently signed between South Korea and the United States just last Friday. Hmm. It's called a Local Provocation Counter Operations Plan. And what this agreement says is, in the event of a local skirmish in the West Sea, and if folks remember, the West Sea is the site of many past skirmishes between North and South Korea in the past, including the most recent one a couple years ago on Yeomphyeong Island. If in the event that such a skirmish happens again, then this agreement gives South Korean field commanders on these islands the discretion to retaliate first and then report later. And South Korean Defense Ministry has already said in the past that it reserves a right for asymmetric retaliation in the event of a provocation from North Korea, meaning that if they're provoked, they will not only retaliate against the source of the origin of the provocation, but also its supporting forces. So what this means is that this agreement can actually increase the possibility that a local skirmish can turn into an all-out confrontation. So the situation right now is a high risk, and it is a very concerning situation.
The local provocation countermeasure plan, is that in any way related to the current ongoing operations of Operational Plan 5029, the American and South Korean military exercises?
Yes. Well, the current exercises that are going on right now is called Key Resolve Full Eagle. It's an annual military exercise. It's been happening since the 80s under different names. It is now, the United States and the South Korean militaries are now openly exercising what you mentioned, the Operation Plan 5029. This was developed in the wake of the death of the former leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-il, back in 2011. And it is a war plan. It's an unconventional war plan, meaning it simulates many different scenarios in which the North Korean regime would collapse. And it outlines plans for how U.S. forces would move in and occupy North Korea. And the exercises routinely mobilize 200,000 South Korean troops, 30,000 U.S. forces, as well as the U.S. as George Washington and stealth fighters, etc.
We're speaking with Hyun Lee of Asia-Pacific Forum and many operations involving the attempt to find peace on the Korean Peninsula, including the national campaign to end the Korean War. And that brings us to one of the statements recently made by Pyongyang, the DPRK, in what in American media was portrayed as saying, we now consider ourselves to have a state of war with South Korea. And if I am not mistaken from my travels to both Koreas, is that not actually a state of armistice, meaning that the war is still ongoing, but there's an agreement to halt the hostilities for an indefinite period of time?
That's right. So for the past 60 years, the Korean Peninsula has been in a constant state of war. The reason being, as you mentioned, at the end of the Korean War in 1953, an armistice was signed, not a permanent peace treaty. So the armistice was meant to be a temporary agreement between the United States, the DPRK, and also I think China was a signatory. South Korea was not. Basically what the armistice states is within 90 days, we should meet again and discuss a permanent solution to the state of conflict, as well as the withdrawal of all foreign forces. Now, it's been 60 years. 28,000 U.S. troops still remain on the Korean Peninsula. There has been no peace treaty signed. So the armistice was the only thing. It was a temporary ceasefire that halted fighting from the Korean War. Now, by North Korea declaring a nullification of that ceasefire, it means that fighting can resume at any time. And this is the unfortunate consequence of not having replaced the armistice with a permanent peace treaty.
One of the other alarming things is the statement from Washington that there is contemplation in the event of conflict of, quote, regime change in Pyongyang and massive retaliation. And I was astonished to see the prospect being considered of U.S. military occupation of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Can you speak to the plausibility of that?
Right. So I think the U.S. mainstream media likes to portray the current crisis as something created solely by North Korea being a bad actor in this situation. What they fail to mention, however, is past U.S. policies and actions that have actually created the current crisis. So just going back in history a little bit, two very significant things happened in 2011. Number one, the death of North Korea's former leader, Kim Jong-il. And number two, Obama's announcement of a shift in U.S. policy to increase naval as well as diplomatic presence in the Asia-Pacific region. So before Kim Jong-il died in 2011, many in South Korea as well as Washington circles predicted that when he dies, the North Korean regime will certainly collapse. However, after his death, North Korea defied everyone's predictions, and it did not collapse. And so since then, the United States has been quietly escalating war threats on the Korean Peninsula. So one example is upgrading its war plans, what we mentioned before, Operation 5029, that envisions regime collapse scenarios and routinely exercising these scenarios in the occupation of North Korea. But in addition, the United States has also been transferring mine-resistant armored vehicles and other types of weaponry that were used in Afghanistan and Iraq. As they draw down from the Middle East, they have been transferring them to the DMZ. the United States also increased South Korea's ballistic missile range from 300 to 800 kilometers. This means that South Korea now has the capability of striking anywhere in North Korean territory with its missiles. And the United States last July also announced the completion of super nuclear bunker busters specifically for use against North Korea. Interestingly, the current U.S. Forces in Korea commander, James Thurman, has experienced fighting in Iraq, and then the special operations commander in Korea was a former special operations general in Afghanistan. So North Korea is aware of all of this, and it's in this context that North Korea is saying we are now nullifying the armistice agreement. So again, this is a very serious situation, and we should be on high alert, and hoping that the situation doesn't get out of control into an all-out confrontation.
Hyun Lee, my reading of the State Department cables that were made available through WikiLeaks indicate that at various times in 2006, 2009, and 2010, there was much speculation from the U.S. embassies in Beijing, China, and in Seoul, South Korea, about the succession that began taking place in 2011. And despite skepticism of some American diplomats and sources, Kim Jong-un did indeed accede to a position of power. But there were also predictions that with the governance, military, economic pressures, that there might well be once more an escalation of rhetoric with the not irrational tactic of North Korea to directly engage the United States in negotiations rather than taking a subservient position to South Korea in any American-imposed settlement and to bypass the six-nation talks. Can you help us understand the diplomatic strategy that might be involved here?
Yeah, for that we need to go back in time once more, a little bit further back. After the fall of the Socialist Trading Bloc, which was back in 1991, North Korea suddenly found itself facing a sudden economic crisis because it lost all of its trading partners, and it was also anxious about its own survival after the Cold War. And so North Korea decided to pursue a dual strategy. Number one, establishing a strategic relationship with the United States because it is now the only remaining superpower, and at the same time developing nuclear weapons, not necessarily at that time to become a nuclear power, but as a deterrent and also a bargaining chip with the United States. And what North Korea wanted at that time were two things: security assurances from the United States that it would not consider it an enemy state and that it would not be attacked, and number two, normalization of relations so that it can develop economically and have normal trade with the United States as well as the international world. The United States, on the other hand, did not reciprocate in that regard and unilaterally demanded denuclearization of North Korea. And that's what the past 20 years of back and forth negotiations, on again, off again, sometimes bilateral, sometimes multilateral negotiations have been about. North Korea wanted a fundamental shift in U.S. policy towards North Korea so that it's not considered an enemy state. Mm. What the United States wanted, on the other hand, was denuclearization of North Korea. And the interesting thing, Jeffrey Bader, he was considered Obama's kind of orchestrator of Obama's North Korea policy. He was the senior director for East Asian Affairs at the White House National Security Council in Obama's last term. He wrote a memoir recently, and in it he says, many of us believed that the most likely long-term solution to the North Korea's nuclear pursuits lay in the North's collapse and absorption into a South-led reunified Korea. At the same time, he says, a strategy was still needed to slow down, freeze, and degrade the North Korean program until history could take its course. So he's remarkably honest about U.S. intentions vis-a-vis North Korea and kind of summarizes in two sentences what essentially was the past 20 years of U.S. policy towards North Korea, which is delay North Korea's nuclear program until the eventual collapse of the North Korean regime. Here we are 20 years later, and you know, last July, the North Korean Foreign Ministry announced, we have actually reviewed the past 20 years of our negotiations with the United States. We no longer have faith that it is working, and what we want is for the United States to act first, meaning this simultaneous action for action agreement that was reached during the six-party talks is out the window, and North Korea wants the United States to act first, meaning, again, security assurance and a commitment to normalize relations.
Our guest is Hyun Lee. She is with the Campaign to End the Korean War. And one of the less noted players in some circles is the nation of China, whose proximity to North Korea gives it a certain special combination of influence and of geostrategic interests. Can you help us understand what the pas de deux, the dance, the relationship is between Pyongyang and Beijing at this critical time?
Yes, I think it's probably a complicated one. Pyongyang and Beijing's military alliance goes back many decades to the Korean War. So they have a close relationship, and I think the Russian media recently reported that China is actually amassing its military troops on the border of North Korea and China, just as the U.S. is flying B-2 stealth bombers in Korea to assure its ally, South Korea. China is doing the same, sending a message that should there be a conflict, even an unintended ignition of conflict on the Korean Peninsula, China is ready to respond. However, I think fundamentally, China has other priorities domestically and as well as in the region. It has labor unrest all throughout China. I think its priority is to make sure it is able to sustain its economic growth and also lead the process of economic integration in the region. I think the last thing China wants is to, frankly, to deal with this headache, this conflict between the U.S. and DPRK, and its message in the recent past, I think, has been to both parties to restrain themselves, talking to North Korea and saying, you need to pipe down your rhetoric, and also playing a role, sending a message to the United States that it needs to de-escalate tensions.
Well, one other area that I think we must address, and that is the statements that Pyongyang is ready to launch missile-bound nuclear weapons to the United States at a point of intolerable conflict or stress. And yet, many technical analysts say that they don't have that capability. So what urgency do you put on the nuclear rhetoric or capabilities?
Right. Well, that is anyone's guess, right? I don't really know what Pyongyang's real nuclear capability is. But I think that in this situation, the White House recently made a statement that, diplomacy is possible as a way out of the current crisis only if Pyongyang will behave itself and come to the table. But actually, I think the ball is in the U.S. court at this point. And the way I see it, the United States has three basic options. Number one, the U.S. can continue to ignore North Korea's threats, which it has been doing. But I think this is risky because North Korea will continue to test nuclear weapons. And this has already fueled conservatives in South Korea and Japan, which have their own nuclear ambitions. One thing that the media is not talking about at all is how is that the United States and South Korea has an atomic energy agreement that is up for renewal next year. So that is being negotiated as we speak this year, and that's why Kerry is in South Korea right now, and Park Geun-hye, the South Korea's new president, will be in D.C. In May. Park Geun-hye's top priority is to renegotiate that agreement so that South Korea can develop its own nuclear weapons. But regional proliferation of nuclear weapons is definitely not within U.S. interest. I think then the second option, obviously, is to risk a frontal confrontation with North Korea. But I think this is also not within U.S. interest because, as you mentioned, North Korea has basically announced our missiles are poised to launch surgical strikes against U.S. bases in South Korea and Japan, possibly even other bases in the Pacific, and as you mentioned, they've also said continental U.S. I don't know about continental U.S., but definitely U.S. bases in South Korea and Japan, and that is not something that the United States wants to risk, is affecting its force posture in the region. Then I think that leaves us with the last option, which I think is the most sensible option, is to abandon regime collapse scenarios and start peace talks to finally end the Korean War and normalize relations with North Korea, which is what North Korea has been demanding all along. I think it is the only path to non-proliferation in the region and also to avoid catastrophic damage.
Well, our guest is Hyun Lee, and she is the co-author, along with Christine Hong, of a policy piece on this crisis called Lurching Towards War, a Postmortem of Strategic Patience. Christine Hong is a professor at the University of California in Santa Cruz, and we're so very proud to have you with us today. Hyun Lee is also co-host of Asia-Pacific Forum, a program that, like 5 O'Clock Shadow, originates at WBAI, and I leave it for you to tell people how they might find out more about what you and others with the campaign to end the Korean War and Asia-Pacific Forum, etc., how they can become more educated and learn what you're doing.
Sure. They can certainly access our website, the National Campaign to End the Korean War. Their website is www.endkoreanwar.org. And then Asia Pacific Forum has its own website, asiapacificforum.org. On April 15th, which is a Monday at 9 p.m., I will be hosting a roundtable with experts on the issue of historical perspectives on the current crisis, as well as the issue of human rights in North Korea. So I hope people will tune in.
Well, it's really been wonderful. We thank you for the insight and shall follow this story very carefully, and we appreciate your work.
Thank you, Robert.
See you soon. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacific Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we continue on the issue, among other things, of nuclear developments in the Asia-Pacific region in regard to Fukushima and the ongoing damage that its fallout is doing to children and neonatals. And the author of a major piece on exactly that subject is our guest now joining us live, Harvey Wasserman of Beyond Nuclear and BeyondNuclear.org. And Harvey, we want to talk about the Asian nuclear crises, but we also had intended to speak about the fatality at Arkansas Nuclear 1, in which we were at first told that only three or four people had been injured when a million-pound generator stator fell and crushed or killed one worker. And now it is claimed that there were eight people injured by Entergy, the operator of the plant. So, and just before today's program, you informed me that there was yet another domestic nuclear power accident. So with that, begin where you will.
Well, there's been some kind of electrical incident at the Callaway nuclear plant in Missouri. The Emmer and the owner of that nuclear plant is not saying much. We don't know much. We may never know much. I mean, that's the way it goes with the nuclear industry. Of course, it's automatic that the industry says that there's been no release, a significant release of radiation, that no one was harmed. At Arkansas Nuclear One, they've been forced to admit that someone was in fact killed, but you know, they had nothing to do with radiation. So the one thing that you know for sure is that they virtually always lie. For 9 years, the nuclear industry said that there was no melting of fuel at Three Mile Island, and then in Pennsylvania after the 1979 meltdown there, and then we discovered that a very substantial amount of fuel did in fact melt at Three Mile Island. We don't really know why there wasn't a much worse release of radiation than there was. So at Fukushima, it's hard to say this because it's so tragic, but the impact of Fukushima now is starting to shape up as being very, very serious. 2 years after the accident, there has been a study, and you know, there's a lot of question about its origin. It appears to be a study having been done by the province, or rather the prefecture of Fukushima, essentially the state, indicating that the thyroid abnormality rate among children in the Fukushima area is over 40%. This is a staggering number. The study involves well over 100,000 people, and the idea that 40% of you know, the people, kids in the area, could have their thyroids impacted is catastrophic. I mean, you know, the cancer rate among these children, the impact in terms of their development, the thyroid is crucial to mental and physical development. You know, these are horrifying numbers, and it's just a tragedy in progress that is almost incomprehensible. And so, you know, we know that radiation came from Fukushima to the United States in a very short period of time, within a week, and that the impacts of this radiation will be substantial in the United States. There are researchers, principally Joe Mangano and Dr. Jeanette Sherman, both in New York, who've asserted that we do have tangible health effects, which are substantial already in the United States from Fukushima. And, of course, this study now indicating huge impacts on the thyroid among children. It's just a horrible tragedy.
Well, Harvey, one of the things that was astonishing about the aftermath of the multiple meltdowns at Fukushima is that that Japanese school children were still allowed to be out in the hot dust that came from the plant that accumulated on the ground. And there were actually statements by some officials that, oh, all you have to do is just rake it over and bury the hot part of the dirt. And in some places, they required the children to stay inside classrooms with sealed windows and such. So I'm getting the impression that there was quite a bit of unadmitted exposure to, well, not only children, but especially children. And can you talk a bit about how young people, especially young girls, have such a high vulnerability to radiation, to the iodine, the cesium, and so on, and what relation that exposure may have to what you are reporting now about the 40% or very high thyroid abnormality rate?
Well, let's look at iodine. Iodine is one of the principal fallout products of a nuclear accident. It was measured both at Three Mile Island and certainly at Chernobyl, and now, of course, at Fukushima, it comes out regularly from nuclear power plants. And radioactive iodine, the principal isotope is iodine-131, is taken up by the body and it goes to the thyroid, mimics salt, mimics non-radioactive iodine, and which is an integral element that feeds the thyroid. And if the iodine is radioactive, it emits a beta particle or an electron, and this electron, if it's being emitted by iodine that's been taken up by the thyroid, it will do damage to the thyroid. It will harm the cells of the thyroid and could stunt the growth of the thyroid or cause the thyroid to become cancerous. And this is not exactly rocket science. This is, you know, basic health physics 101. And so we would expect this kind of outbreak of thyroid problems in the Fukushima area. But the number of 40% at this point in time is staggering. And there's, you know, radiation was emitted all over Japan. There was one alleged refutation that was actually published at Huffington Post where someone said, well, there were higher rates of thyroid abnormalities in three locations in Japan farther from Fukushima than these studies. Well, you know, the fact is that radiation went all over Japan, and we don't know where it went, and it's quite possible for at a huge emission like Fukushima, for radiation to come, larger quantities of radiation to come down further away from the plant than closer. This is just something that comes with the territory. So this is not good news, and coming from Fukushima, and the fact that this industry is just collapsing all around us. You can read about this, by the way, at the website I edit, nukefree.org, nukefree.org. That's nukefree.org, nukefree.org. I regularly publish articles about nuclear developments that are happening around the world. And, you know, the steady flow of bad news from Fukushima has not abated. And now we're seeing these two accidents in very close succession at Arkansas Nuclear One and at Callaway in Missouri. And we have an ongoing battle, well, in New York, of course, over Indian Point, which should be shut as soon as possible. It's such a catastrophic harbinger of bad things, Indian Point. Oyster Creek in New Jersey needs to shut. Salem in New Jersey. All these reactors are very, very old and really getting into a decrepit state, including there are two reactors at San Onofre between Los Angeles and San Diego. And these two plants were fitted with defective steam generators at the cost of $765 million. And they've sprung leaks. And the owners, the owning utilities, wants to reopen these plants one of them anyway, the unit two, on an experimental basis. This is utter insanity. These defective steam generators, they want to open this reactor at 70% power as opposed to 100% power and essentially see what happens. And, you know, they're asking the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to do this. It's just staggering that anybody in their right mind would think of doing such a thing.
Harvey Wasserman of nukefree.org, you know very well that nuclear isotopes honor no nation and obey the wind and ocean currents of this planet. And we might presume that in the stratospheric regions, parts of the longer lasting isotopes, cesium, et cetera, might still be in play in the atmospheric circulation of the Earth. But there is also the ocean current of the Pacific, in which you alluded earlier to the arrival now of waterborne particulates from the Fukushima disaster. And I believe you said that there are already some tangible effects from that carryover from Fukushima. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, we've been hauling in, people have been hauling in radioactive tuna. The American Environmental Protection Agency, or whatever agency is responsible for monitoring radiation in fish caught in the Pacific, has stopped doing it. They stopped doing it very soon after the Fukushima accident on orders from the Obama administration.
Wait. Please explain that. Why would there be orders to not monitor?
You tell me. It makes no sense. But they've not been monitoring fish for radiation coming out of the Pacific since shortly after Fukushima. This is a disaster. I mean, and the public is not being protected, to say the least. So, you know, these situations are extremely serious. And Fukushima has been pouring radiation into the Pacific at a god-awful rate. Now, they're trying to build a succession of tanks on the Fukushima site to contain the huge quantities of radioactive liquid that's being produced there. But it's a futile effort. you know, this is really an apocalyptic situation. And we are in very, very serious danger. The health of the planet, the health of the Pacific Ocean in particular, is just under very serious attack. And yet this industry continues to operate some 400 reactors around the world, and 102 in the United States. Two are shutting this year in the United States, Kewaunee in Wisconsin and Crystal River in Florida. But, you know, we want these two at San Onofre to stay shut. We need Indian Point and the other New York area reactors to shut, including Vermont Yankee, as soon as possible. This is an industry that's on its last legs and is increasingly dangerous every day. These reactors are old, and their parts are worn out from intense heat and radiation. There is absolutely no sane reason to continue to operate these reactors.
Our guest is Harvey Wasserman of NukeFree.org, and he's also the author of Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth. And Harvey, I guess the ultimate question for you is, with all of these knowable consequences, not just Fukushima, but the ongoing operation of nuclear power plants that are called civilian in nature, despite their connection to fueling the atomic bomb weapon production system, the amount of distress to the planet and to healthy living organisms is astonishing. And yet the industry proceeds and the statements remain bland, and it takes, there are only a relatively small number of people who are actually doing analytic studies like yourself. And here's that question. Has protest about the dangers and bad economics of nuclear power, has protest been scrammed? Or has the idea of prudent concern about the consequences been buried in the boron of indifference?
No, people are on the case, but, you know, it's very difficult to get the corporate media to pay any attention at all. We did get some coverage during Fukushima, and now it's disappeared. Nobody does, well, very, very small handful of people do meaningful research in the health impacts of these reactors. There's plenty of people out there protesting and trying to keep these reactors from killing us all, but there's no coverage from the major media. So NukeFree.org, Beyond Nuclear, you mentioned, .org, Nuclear Information Resource Service, Greenpeace. There are organizations that follow this and that do cover it, but the corporate media will not.
Well, I want to thank you so very much for being with us today, Harvey Wasserman. And once more, please tell people how to follow your work and Kindred Revelations.
Yeah, so come to NukeFree.org, NukeFree.org, and solartopia.org. One thing, Robert, we've talked on the show before, the hopeful development is that we do have renewables now, wind, solar, tidal, geothermal, ocean thermal, biofuels, that can more than power our global economy. When we first started fighting nuclear power, this wasn't the case, but renewable technologies now advanced to the point where in a solartopian scenario, all nuclear and all fossil fuels can be done away with, and that includes fracking. We do have the technical capabilities to run our entire global economy on renewables, increased efficiency, conservation, and so we need to take that option as soon as possible. That's the solartopian vision, and you can see that at solartopia.org.
Well, thank you, Harvey Wasserman, NukeFree.org also. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we culminate today's program with the recollection that it was 4 decades and 5 years ago that a great leader was taken from us when a sniper assassin murdered the civil rights and human rights and anti-war and economic reformer, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. The assassination of Dr. King came 1 year, 1 month, and 1 day after the then head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, J. Edgar Hoover, issued a memorandum saying that offices of the FBI should be involved in the neutralizing the disruption and prevention of the rise of a black messiah. And as Dr. King, in 1967, delivered that seminal speech on Beyond Vietnam at the Riverside Church in New York City, calling the United States government the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. It was around that time that the FBI and other federal agencies and private institutions engaged in the suppression of the civil rights movement and the assassination of a great many leaders during that period of time, including Malcolm X. And it was during this time that the FBI said the purpose, and here we quote, "The purpose of this new counterintelligence endeavor is to expose, disrupt, misdirect, discredit, or otherwise neutralize the activities of black nationalist hate-type organizations and groupings, their leadership, spokesmen, membership, and supporters." And Hoover went on to say that the offices of the FBI should, quote, "prevent the rise of a messiah who could unify and electrify the militant black nationalist movement. Malcolm X might have been such a messiah. Martin Luther King, Stokely Carmichael, and Elijah Muhammad all aspire to this position. King could be a very real contender for this position should he abandon his supposed obedience to white liberal doctrines." J. Edgar Hoover, director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And we conclude today's program with the following, an excerpt from one of his most powerful and analytic speeches given on the 16th of August, 1967, to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
As we talk about where do we go from here, we must honestly face the fact that the movement must address itself to the question of restructuring the whole of American society. There are 40 million poor people here. And one day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you're raising a question about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy. And I'm simply saying that more and more, we've got to begin to ask questions about the whole society. We are called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. It means that questions must be raised. And you see, my friends, when you deal with this, you begin to ask the question, who owns the oil? You begin to ask the question, who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that's two-thirds water? These are words that must be said. Now, don't think you have me in a bind today. I'm not talking about communism. What I'm talking about is far beyond communism. My inspiration didn't come from Karl Marx. My inspiration didn't come from Engels. My inspiration didn't come from Trotsky. My inspiration didn't come from Lenin. Yes, I read Communist Manifesto and Das Kapital a long time ago. And I saw that maybe Marx didn't follow Hegel enough. He took his dialectics, but he left out his idealism and his spiritualism, and he went over to a German philosopher by the name of Feuerbach and took his materialism and made it into a system that he called dialectical materialism. I have to reject that. What I'm saying to you this morning, communism forgets that life is individual. Capitalism forgets that life is social. And the kingdom of brotherhood is found neither in the thesis of communism nor the antithesis of capitalism, but in a higher synthesis. found in a higher synthesis that combines the truths of both. Now, when I say question in the whole society, it means ultimately coming to see that the problem of racism, the problem of economic exploitation, and the problem of war are all tied together. These are the triple evils that are interrelated. And if you will let me be a preacher just a little bit, one night a juror came to Jesus, and he wanted to know what he could do to be saved. Jesus didn't get bogged down on the kind of isolated approach of what you shouldn't do. Jesus didn't say, "Now, Nicodemus, you must stop lying." He didn't say, "Nicodemus, now you must not commit adultery." He didn't say, "Now, Nicodemus, you must stop cheating if you're doing that." He didn't say, "Nicodemus, you must stop drinking liquor if you're doing that excessively." He said something altogether different, because Jesus realized something basic. That if a man will lie, he will steal. And if a man will steal, he will kill. So instead of just getting bogged down on one thing, Jesus looked at him and said, "Nicodemus, you must be born again." In other words, your whole structure must be changed. A nation that will keep people in slavery for 244 years will thingify them and make them things. And therefore, they will exploit them and poor people generally, economically. And a nation that will exploit economically will have to have foreign investments and everything else, and it will have to use its military might to protect them. All of these problems are tied together. What I'm saying today is that we must go from this convention and say, "America, you must be born again." So I conclude by saying today that we have a task, and let us go out with a divine dissatisfaction. Let us be dissatisfied until America will no longer have a high blood pressure of creeds and an anemia of deeds. Let us be dissatisfied until the tragic walls that separate the outer city of wealth and comfort from the inner city of poverty and despair shall be crushed by the battering rams of the forces of justice. Let us be dissatisfied until they live on the outskirts of hope, are brought into the metropolis of daily security. Let us be dissatisfied until slums are cast into the junk heaps of history, and every family will live in a decent sanitary home. Let us be dissatisfied until the dark yesterdays of segregated schools will be transformed into bright tomorrows of quality integrated education. Let us be dissatisfied until integration is not seen as a problem, but as an opportunity to participate in the beauty of diversity. Let us be dissatisfied until men and women, however black they may be, will be judged on the basis of the content of their character, not on the basis of the color of their skin. Let us be dissatisfied. Let us be dissatisfied until every state capital be housed by a governor who will do justly, who will love mercy and who will walk humbly with his God. Let us be dissatisfied. Until from every city hall justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Let us be dissatisfied until that day when the lion and the lamb shall lie down together. And every man will sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid. Let us be dissatisfied. The men will recognize that out of one blood, God made all men to dwell upon the face of the earth. Let us be dissatisfied until that day when nobody will shout white power, when nobody will shout black power, but everybody will talk about God's power and human power.
Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Sometimes it causes me to tremble. Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Were you there when they laid him in the tomb? And were you there when they laid his precious body in the tomb? Oh, sometimes it causes me I tremble. And were you there when they laid him in the tomb? But were you there when he rose from the grave? Cry, yeah. And I begin to tremble. I tremble. Were you there when he rose from the
Thank you for listening today to 5 o'clock Shadow.